Yay! Well, thank you so much for the introduction and for being here, for allowing me to be here. I opened up my last little talk with the same couple sentences, but it's super true even to say it to this crowd. Over the last day and a half, I've had so many good conversations with people who work all over the place doing great work, and I'm very humbled by the opportunity to actually stand before any of you, because I feel like Matt and I could switch spots at any time with this stuff. And I'm really excited for this this talk, because looking out there, I see a lot more students, which is great. So I'm going to lean more towards student stuff than teacher stuff on this. So teachers, ask questions at the end. So first, what I'm going to do is give you a bit of background on the Pease Farm. Pease Farm was started, our first season was 1997. And a couple things make the model of the Pease Farm somewhat unique. The first one, that the farm on campus, actually the farm's off campus, but the farm was started simultaneously with a nonprofit called Garden City Harvest. Garden City Harvest, the nonprofit, leases the land on which the Pease Farm exists. Garden City Harvest, the nonprofit's main mission is food security. That means getting high-quality food to low-income people. The other two parts of the mission for Garden City Harvest are one, creating educational opportunities in ecologically conscious agriculture. And then the third one is to use our sites for the personal restoration of troubled youth and adults. And I'll get to that in a little bit. We have four neighborhood farms in our small city. The Pease Farm is but one. So, one unique feature, we're partnered up with a nonprofit. The nonprofit buys all the stuff for the farm. That means the fuel for the tractor, the fencing, the tractor itself, seeds, the hoop houses, everything. The university doesn't pay for any of that. The university sends me there to teach students and sends what would be a bunch of you all there to do the work. And this is a great partnership. It's very clean. This is not the only way these things can work by any stretch. Every student farm seems to have found its own way. But this is one way that I know works out well. It's worked out well for us because in our environmental studies program, my boss, a great person, has said to me straight out, we are not in the farming business. We don't want to be in the farming business. He's in the education business. You can come in. It's always exciting to have more people. Come on in. So he said to me, we're in the education business. The environmental studies program at the University of Montana wants to provide students with great educational experiences. Our department has activism as our number one goal. So we want students to leave our program and go do things to make the world a better place. My personal definition of education. Education is an experience that sends someone down a road to work thoughtfully and passionately for a better world. And a student farm does exactly that. So the unique feature of this, the university and the nonprofit have responsibilities that are very cleanly divided. The university does not own the land, does not have a say in buildings or equipment or budget or anything. They want from me really good student evaluations and good press and a super solid connection to the community. They don't care how I plant my carrots. Our carrots. The other thing that I feel like is somewhat unique, not entirely, but somewhat unique, is that the students who are there for credit. The experience we provide is absolutely transformational. People who do this for the summer come out changed. And I can describe the character of that in just a moment. But it really works. And like I said, my definition of education, a transformational experience sends you down a road to work thoughtfully and passionately for a better world. The farm does that. That means they should pay for it. So they take 6 credits in the summer. That 6-credit class works like this. Starts the Friday after finals week is over. No rest for the weary. Starts the Monday before school begins. That's a harder adjustment. Students get 6 credits. They're there Monday through Thursday, 8 to 12. All of them. They're not in shifts. We're not paying them. They pay us because it's that great. And your guys is that great. I was so blown away yesterday at listening to Matt and Jen. I'm like, they're paying people? They should be paying you. Monday through Thursday, students work from 8 to 12. Twice a week, we have CSA harvest. We have 90 members, 90 households in our CSA, and we have an obligation to the Missoula Food Bank to get them 15,000 pounds of food every year. They have paid us money for that. They pay us $5,000. We get them 15,000 pounds of food. Now, they value food at $1.50 a pound, and they have a couple $100,000 set aside to buy food. So we are giving them a deal and a half. It's like a donation. We give them 15,000 pounds of food. They give us $5,000. Financially, even more important, 90 households have given us $500 to get 18 weeks of the finest vegetables we could possibly grow. So the production obligations are very real. Oh, but wait a minute. I just said, oh, this is educational, right? The educational experience is enhanced. It's made better. It's deeply informed by the very real production obligations. What we're doing is not purely academic. We're not just going to grow some food and then we bring whatever we get to the dining hall. And I know you guys don't do that, but we have 90 people who are showing up at 4:30, fully expecting to see beautiful food laid out on our table. And it's really important that they walk in our building and go, ooh. And we do color breaks and topographical breaks. I mean, it looks nicer than the best farmer's market stand. It's my thesis that the educational experience is enhanced by the production obligations. The feeling of that intensity on those harvest days or dealing with weather windows makes them learn more. And because it's educational, we do better production-wise. Because they're learning about the difference between hard-neck and soft-neck garlic, we're going to plant garlic more thoughtfully. So what could look like a tension from the outside, or how do you deal with education if it's a production farmer? How do you deal with production if it's an education farm? These things run beautifully together, and I would say inform one another. So that's a bit of background on our farm. I didn't run through the whole schedule. Monday through Thursday, 8 to 12, this is a key piece of it. At noon, we go into our barn. It's not really a barn. We call it a barn, but it's our main farm center building that we built. We go into our barn, and we eat lunch. Not a dramatic thing at noon, but what's dramatic is two kids didn't work in the fields that day. They stayed in our barn and made lunch for everyone else out of food that we grew. Now, we pool our money so we can buy grains and oil and other things like that. This summer, 15 people eating lunch together 4 days a week for the entire summer cost everyone $40. So two $20 bills got you lunch all summer. Now, really important here, we eat together. Also important is that we learn to cook with the food that we're growing. A couple other pieces of this farm. We have an education program and a youth program. The education program, we get about 2,500 kids on field trips up to the farm every fall on field trips. And there's another course at the university in environmental ed where students are leading these field trips. So in the midst of all this work, there's children running around. And it makes it better. We also have a program called Youth Harvest where we have a small group of teenagers who are in Missoula drug court. Some of them are also in youth homes, living in group homes. 3 to 5 of those kids work with the PEA students during the summertime. And they're integrated into our community of students. And the community of students, much like the community of students here, are optimistic. They're psyched to be there. They see the beauty all around them, and they're really pumped up about the good they can do in the world. The Youth Harvest kids are not that way. They're in the juvenile justice system. They suffer mostly from being very guilty of having crappy families. And they are not optimistic. They're not psyched. And having that small group being absorbed into the larger group of students, a magical thing happens. They rise to that culture. So we've got teenagers, we got all these college students, and we have small children running around, and we have some community volunteers, all intermixed, Monday through Thursday, and then we eat lunch. Sometimes lunch is burned rice and badly cooked vegetables. Sometimes it's spectacular. You just tough it out. It gets much better as the year goes on. On Fridays, we have a class where we sit in a circle at the farm and I talk about bugs or weeds or soil or tractors or irrigation or whatever, those sorts of topics. And we have a reader that complements that. And then after the talk, believe it or not, they're still awake. After the talk, we go on a field trip to visit a farm in the area. And we are rich in local farms, not nearly as rich as the Northeast. It's just awe-inspiring to be here and hearing and seeing what the farm community is like here. We have a much smaller one, but it's very vital, very alive, and very cohesive. Because it's so cohesive, they're my friends. I can bring my students there, and the students ask hard questions. Like, how much money do you make on that? And what's it like raising your kids in an environment where you work 7 days a week? interacting with people who do this for a livelihood is really educational because the kids are kind of in farm camp where it's super fun to work a half day. So that's how the structure works Monday through Friday. What I wanted to give you that little background so you had it in your idea of what we're working with. And I start in here talking about fertility. The other thing I want to tell you about is where the farm is. It's in Missoula, Montana. A really, really great place. Anybody know River Runs Through It? It was a famous movie a bunch of years ago. Great book. One of the last lines of the book. There are a lot of bastards in the world and they increase in density and number the farther you get from Missoula, Montana. And I'm here to tell you it's true, but you don't have to move there. So a lot of people may have a version of Montana that is just wide open and people spread out in rural areas. This part of Pennsylvania is more rural. Montana is more remote. People in Montana are concentrated into population centers with vast open spaces separating them. We do not have all these beautiful little towns. Yesterday morning, I went off to visit an Amish farm with Heidi. She was super nice of her to tour me around. Matt set it up. I couldn't really tell where one town stopped and another one began. And they were all beautiful. It was really nice. In Montana, it's a population center, open space, another population center. Our farm is in a population center. We are land limited. Here, I'm getting to fertility. I just wanted to get you the background. So visiting your guys' farm, one of the things I was so in awe of was like, look at all this space. If that cornfield back there is yours too. Like, wow. You guys are doing great. I was blown away. It was super beautiful and really, really great. And like, wow, look at all that space, all that opportunity. We have 9.75 acres and that is it forevermore. We have a soccer field to the south of us, private land to the north, hills and a creek on either side. Both hills are public land, which is great, and neighborhoods. There will be no more. So the idea of moving around and being, you know, really broad and expansive with rotations, we can't do that. And we're really committed to being sustainable in a long-term way. So how do we answer this riddle? That's the big question. So I'm going to step back for a moment and talk about how fertility would work in nature. And you may all know this, but I give this little snippet to my students because we're right next to a creek. And here we are on our farm. We're applying compost and we're doing cover crops and we're fussing over every little detail and pouring all kinds of energy into it. Meanwhile, you look right over the fence along the riparian area, along the creek, beautiful Rattlesnake Creek. There is mad vegetation growing there. Mad vegetation. Trees, herbs, forbs, grasses, everything. And nobody put down any compost. What the hell happened there? And if you go and dig underneath the trees, I'm going to borrow some language. I can't remember the guy who said this, but you look at right underneath the trees, you see leaves that are identifiable by species. Oh, that was a maple, and that was a birch, and this was a pine. These are pine needles from a ponderosa pine, and we call them pea pines where I live. And these are Doug firs. You can see, right, what they are. You dig a little deeper, and they're leaves and pine needles, but they're not so distinguishable as to species. You dig a little deeper than that, now we're like the length of my hand. And it's gorgeous humus. You know what humus is, right? Everybody give me a one-sentence definition. Here we go. I'll give you one. Fully decomposed organic matter. It can't decompose anymore. Organic matter is anything used to be alive. Fully decomposed organic matter is humus. And humus is the source of fertility on the whole planet. Aside from the stuff we inject. It's the source of fertility for the whole planet. Now, looking at that situation under the trees, you had to dig down the length of your hand to get to the humus. Above that was the stuff that looked like leaves and pine needles, but it was breaking down. That's humus for next year. And on top of that was the birch leaves and the maple leaves and was all identified. That's the next year. So down there by the creek, that system is making fertility at a surplus. We're just trying to get by, right? And the whole country's now, oh, we're up in arms about our deficit. Can you imagine? A surplus. Amazing. And nobody's fussing with it. So, on our little farm, we grow mad vegetation. Sounded familiar, right? You look at the fields, full of beautiful vegetables. It's all really great. But twice a week, there's this big gash. It's a hemorrhage. Okay, we'll see if I've done a good job of this. Where is all that organic matter hemorrhaging to twice a week? It is not going back into the earth. Where is it going? To the CSA. Very good. Yeah. You go onto that CSA table, well, there's all the cabbage and broccoli and carrots and potatoes and beans and all the rest of it. It's not going back into the earth. There's a big hole in this system. So we have to get organic matter back into the system without ruining the soil. So one of my models for this is from really my farming mentors in Montana, and I'm an old guy already, so these people are even older. It's a Lifeline Vegetable Farm. Premier vegetable farm. They have 42 acres. They grow 9 acres of vegetables. 42 acres. So they got a vegetable field, and then they have a field where they grow hay, and then they have a field where their animals are on pasture. And every 3 years, it moves. Brilliant and elegant. They're generating tons of their own manure. They get some manure from the farm next door, too, but they generate tons of their own manure, and they grow their own food for their cows. And really importantly, their soil stays in beautiful shape. So, and I'll get to why in just a moment. So you look at our situation on our 9.75 acres that is fully bounded. This is not an option for us. We can't have that many cows. So what are we going to do? Well, we're a community farm. And I hope that I described that when I was telling you about the background. Right? Remember that? We got kids coming. We got teenagers coming. We send food to senior citizens centers. We send food to the food bank. We're enmeshed in the town. And I had this realization, it's a bunch of years ago, that the boundaries of our farm wasn't the fence line. It works great at Lifeline Farm in the Bitterroot Valley. The boundaries of the farm are the fence line. For us, the boundaries of our farm, we're a public urban farm, right? The boundaries of our farm are the boundaries of the valley. That's our farm. We serve that, and we can look to that valley for resources. So we started making lots of compost. So thinking about that natural system, remember the natural system I was talking about? All that decomposition of organic matter. Manure is a great source because cows eat grass, right? More organic matter. But inside the cow, they decompose a whole lot of it for us. I mean, to going from grass to humus, the cow does like this much work. We just have this much left to do. So on one side of our town, we have this thing called the Missoula Livestock Exchange, where cows are brought to be sold. And they're there for a short time, sometimes a week, sometimes 2 weeks, and then they're sold. But since there are so many cows there, they make a lot of manure. And over on that side of town, it's really an environmental liability. They have these mountains of manure, and it's leaching this coffee-colored water, and it's bad. Well, it's in our valley. We scoop it up. Unfortunately, we have to scoop it up about 25 times in big-ass dump trucks, drive it across the valley, but it's just across the valley. It's not like across the state. It's literally across the valley. Put that at our farm, and then we get straw from people who grow barley down the south end of the valley. Again, our valley. They're growing barley. The straw is a waste product. We take straw, and we mix it with manure and make compost. And that compost is way, way closer to humus than either of those elements, the grass that the cow is going to eat or the barley growing in the field, would be otherwise. Now, you could just say, well, we'll just put manure down. We could just get the manure. Manure is full of nitrogen. Nitrogen, as you may all know, is pretty volatile. It wants to move around. If we just left that manure in a pile, a bunch of it would go up into the air. And a bunch of it would leach down into the groundwater, just like it's doing at the livestock exchange. But if we mix that manure with straw, a bunch of the nitrogen that's in the manure gets bound up in the decomposition of the straw. Mixing manure and straw together is a way to sequester nitrogen, to keep nitrogen from fleeing. So we mix the manure and straw, and we do it in two ways. One way is just like you guys do, like Matt and Jen do with their compost. We put it in the bottom of manure. We put straw on the bottom of the manure spreader, and then we put manure on top of it and fire up the manure spreader and chug, 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 and it spews out and it makes a nice pile. I may read something a little bit later I have in my computer about using manure spreaders. They break a lot. I've been really intimate with our manure spreaders. involved in every little piece, and man, they break often, and they're a pain in the ass. And what we really need is a really nice manure spreader. Now, they are very expensive. How old is yours? Is it an 08 model, or is it a... You bought a new one. Now, it looked like a nice one, but I couldn't tell how old it was. They haven't changed that much. I mean, ours is probably 30 years old, and it basically looks like that externally, but it probably doesn't run like that. So we make it in two ways with a manure spreader. Actually, three ways. Manure spreader, where you layer straw and manure, chugs down the conveyor, shred it up, shot out into the air in this big cloud of manure and dust, straw dust, and then it falls down to the ground full of air. Makes a nice pile, but it's full of air. The air is really important. Because for all that decomposition to happen, microorganisms have to get busy. And they need air to breathe to get busy. And that's more than anything, that's what that manure spreader does. It blends everything and it adds air to that mix. And then the microbes just take off. This is why turning a compost pile leads to a big jump in microbial activity and decomposition. Because you're adding air. And the microbes, it's like a dose of oxygen to a fire. So it just takes right off. The other two ways we make it. One way is we do this lasagna kind of thing by hand. Shred up straw about 4 feet wide, maybe 30, 40 feet long, 4 to 6 inches thick, and then we put manure on top of that, a couple inches of manure, then more straw, then more manure. We do this sometimes when we have large groups of people who want to volunteer. This can put them to work, and they do something that is valuable. And everybody can do it regardless of skill level. So we've had like a church group from Indiana is out, and there's 40 people. That's vandalism. That's not agriculture. Right? But we can make a big-ass compost pile, and which is great. And then later we'll turn it with the tractor, and it's not make work. It is make work, but it's make opportunity. And they did something of value. And actually, compost piles made that way are really beautiful. The other way we do it, when our manure spreader's broken, which has been too much, is using the bucket of the tractor. So we shred up straw by hand, use the bucket of the tractor to make a pile of straw, pile of manure, mix them all together, and it's far less homogeneous and beautiful and full of air than the manure spreader method. But in a pinch, and unfortunately we've had too many pinches, it does work. So we make compost. That's one way to get manure, get organic matter back into the soil, because we have that gushing wound of harvesting, right? The other thing we do is to grow cover crops. Cover crop, technically, anything you grow to make your soil better, not to harvest, that's a cover crop. Anything you grow just to improve the quality of your soil. So we grow rye, we grow oats. We grow vetch, some clover, some peas, all the kind of standard stuff. We're fairly limited, though. We have a tight season. I feel so sorry. I'm putting this poor woman to sleep. I'll be snappier. We are limited with our season. Our last frost is the end of April. Our first frost is mid-September to the end of September, which might not be that different than here, but what's so limiting about it is during the year we have very little heat. It's a super dry place, which may sound enviable being here in Car Drizzle, as I was told that was called. We get about 12 inches of rain a year, next to no humidity. We have lots of surface water, rivers and lakes, tons of snowmelt, but no water in the air. So this means, with no water in the air means no humidity, that means nighttime temperatures are really low. So it can be 95 during the day, it'll be 55 at night in mid-August. That means an average temperature of 75 degrees, and for vegetables to ripen, average temperature is much more meaningful than high temperature. So for us to grow tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes outside, pretty much impossible. Melons, almost out of the question. We have to be super careful about which tomato varieties, eggplant varieties, pepper varieties we grow, because our season is really short, and within that season, it's cold. Even though it can be 95 and gorgeous during the day. So we have a limited amount of time to work with. How does this relate to cover crops? Well, we plant, let's say, with our spring greens. Spring greens. Anybody want to tell me what a spring green is? Just let me know you're still awake. Some salad. Anything else? What are the green things you might grow in springtime? Are any farm students here I can pick on? Chard and kale. But we do chard and kale all year, too. I'm thinking like bok choy and peas and spinach. Any of the Asian greens like mizuna and arugula, which you could grow all year, but really they're springtime. Other things like kohlrabi and the first cabbage. All that spring stuff. So we put all of our spring things in a block. So they're starting at the same time, which is good because we're only having to irrigate that part of the field as opposed to the whole thing in spring, because irrigation is a big part of what we do. So we irrigate one block of the field for springtime. Those things all come out about the same time, early July. They're done. So now we have half the summer to work with. So we mow it, we till it in, and then we plant a cover crop. But which cover crop to plant? And this is where that short season part of cover crops is important. We only have a month and a half to work with. So we can't plant Sudan grass. We're not going to get anything. Or if we have a cold, wet spring like we did this year, just a bummer of a spring. We didn't have a day over 55 degrees until the first day of summer. So June 22nd, it was like 71. Before that, it was sleet blowing sideways in the 50s. Just miserable. So we don't have very many cover crop options to work with. So we spread compost and we grow these annual cover crops. That annual cover crop might go in mid-summer. We grow rye and winter peas, which can follow up late summer crops. So they're out in September and August. We can plant rye. But anything that's done end of September or October, we can't plant anything. And those cover crops and the compost have to be tilled in. This is really a big deal. We use a tool called a spader. Matt and Jen have one too. I totally love it. It does an incredible good job. As you pointed out yesterday, you can reach your hand in after it's spaded and you can find a little clod of soil with a worm coming in one end and a worm going out the other end. It doesn't kill all the worms. And it lifts soil up in a certain profile. The profile that it comes up in, that's how it goes back. So it doesn't invert soil structure. So you don't get rocks from 10 inches down below on top like a rotavator does. And a rotavator, which is a rototiller on the back of a tractor, similar style implement, shreds up the soil really fast. There's a great word. It kind of comes from tillage. It's called tilth. Anybody know what tilth means? You're doing the right thing with your hands. You're totally doing the right thing with your hands. You grab a handful of soil. How does it feel? It's literally the texture of the soil. And what I'm really referring to here, not just the texture, but the diversity of crumb sizes. So are you getting a big ones, little ones, small ones, medium-sized ones, or are they all kind of just the same? If you get big ones, little ones, medium-sized ones, then there's lots of air spaces. Remember what air was good for? Okay, somebody let me know you're still awake. Right. All that air gets to the microbes, so the microbes can eat the organic matter to make the humus, so the plants are going to grow. And you said compaction, and you're totally right. Because if there was no diversity in crumb sizes, if they're all ground small like sand, you're not going to get much air in there. Even if it doesn't feel hard, you're not going to get much air in there. No air also means water because it travels through the same pathways. And little rootlets go in all those places. So this spader that I so love has these paddles that go like this. Lifts soil up, takes that whole soil profile, slams it up against a big metal plate, breaks into a zillion little pieces, falls back down again. And you go through there after the spader has gone by, and you can put your arm in, like up to there. It's freaking gorgeous. Just beautiful. Now, what we want to happen in the soil is for the organic matter to be eaten by microbes to make humus, right? Well, what the spader does is buries all that organic matter, cuts it up, but it also shreds up other little tiny pieces of organic matter in its process of shredding things up. And it breaks those clods into smaller clods. And if you use it over and over again, you get the homogeneous soil structure you get with a rotavator, but it doesn't happen as long. But if you use a spader over and over, year in, year out, we can maintain fertility by adding manure or adding compost. And by doing our annual cover crops, we can maintain fertility, but we will ruin our tilth. We will ruin the character of the soil by tilling it over and over again. And tilling is so efficient for getting organic matter into the soil, for getting air into the soil, for making beautiful garden beds. And here we are on our little tight 9.75 acres. We can't do the awesome Lifeline Farm rotations. We couldn't do what you guys might be able to do with move up into that cornfield. Man, looks tough. Well, what we decided to do was take a portion of the field and not till it. Plant it so it's got roots growing in it, but don't touch it with the tiller for 3 years. And then we come back to it. This year was our first year on a new patch. We tilled up that ground that had been in cover crop for 3 years. It was gorgeous. Beautiful. It was so much more beautiful than it was before. tilled it up and reached in for the handful of soil, and the diversity of crumb structure is spectacular, and it's full of all these little rootlets from the cover crop, and it smells like organic matter. It's just like, man, that is the best soil on the planet. You know, deep, rich, black, spectacular. And it didn't look like that when it went into that three-year cover crop. Now, if we were more ambitious, maybe we could graze it a little bit, but it's just, you know, 2.5 acres or so, 3 acres, and we already have enough to do, and I didn't, maybe somebody will be like, I really want to do sheep, and they'll put some sheep there. But we just keep it open. And like I said, this is a public farm. The third Thursday of August, we have a really big party there. 750 people from our town came to the farm this year. Thanks, man. 750 people came to the farm. We grilled organic burgers for 750 people from my buddy Ernie's farm down the way. And we, the students and I, made carrot salad, roasted beets, cucumber salad, and salad mix salad for 750 people. Really fun. It was super fun. And the students get to show off their great work. And the place looks, it's all buffed out and gorgeous by the third Thursday in August. And everybody's walking around going, ah. And it's not just because the vegetables look good. It's situated in a really beautiful valley that you'll see. So that cover crop patch, that's where the party is. A double duty. If you have a public farm, you should celebrate the good work you do and really invite people there and ingratiate your farm into the community. That's just what I talked about in the previous hour. But having this big cover crop patch gives you a place to do that. So we pull in a flatbed trailer, a band plays on the trailer, the whole cover crop patch is filled with people dancing. It's super fun. So our method for getting around not having enough land to do the Lifeline Farm model of grazing ground, hay ground, vegetable ground, and rotation, our way to get around that is to use community resources, the manure from the livestock auction, make our own compost, and to set a smaller chunk of ground out in no-till, growing and no-tillage for 3 years, and then we come back to it. That's been our fertility strategy in a land-limited situation. So what I want to do now is show you some pictures. I feel like if I just turned the lights off, everybody would have been out. So I wanted to talk with you first. Now I'm going to show you some pictures of these things, and then we'll do some questions. Sam's going to make the lights go down. This is the city that I live in and love dearly. Missoula, Montana. This is looking west. That's Squaw Peak right there. There's a river runs through the town. It's a economically alive and vibrant place. A river runs right through the middle of town. That's the Clark Fork River. This is literally in the heart of Missoula. And this spot right here, actually, oops, I'm going to go back one. So can I do the pointer? Right there. It's right off the picture. There's a kayaking play wave that was recently built. And you can bike over this bridge in a bike lane now and see people playing on Brendan's Wave. It's a kayak play wave. Kayaking is very popular. Look either direction. On a summer day, you'll probably see somebody fly fishing. The river used to be super foul when I went to college here, but now it's the longest EPA site in America. Super fun site. So it's cleaned up. This spot right here, a 15-minute bike ride up a hill. You go up the hill to the Pease Farm. These two mountains right here, Jumbo and Sentinel, they're kind of iconic in our valley. And right between them, the Clark Fork River runs between them right into this big bowl of the valley where you just were. 15-minute bike ride up the valley to the Pease Farm. This is up the hill taking a look. This is our land-limited situation. So there's our parking lot. We got this side of the parking lot. We water overhead. This side of the parking lot, we have a separate well. This is all on drip. And here's our compost yard right there. There's our barn or farm center. We have a tool shed, hoop house, greenhouse, and propagation tool shed where we make potting mix. This is the Pease Farm looking south down the valley. And I did tell you, we grow mad amounts of organic matter. There it is. You probably noticed some Remay here. We're a very Remay-intensive farm. Remay is a floating row cover made of polypropylene. Lifts temperatures 3 to 4 degrees. It is cold here. We are super Remay-intensive. So we grow lots and lots of organic matter. There's some potatoes and corn. This is some of the same potatoes and corn earlier in the spring. See the sky here? Looked like this for 6 frickin' weeks. Just brutal. I don't know why students are really fascinated by vegetables that are as big as their head. So this is Riley, a super great kid with cabbage as big as your head, next to the corn, next to carrots, but you can see what our fields look like. This is lettuce as big as your head. Great year for strawberries this year. We harvested more than 200 pounds of strawberries. This girl came from Bowdoin College to work with us for the summer. And you can see the hills behind her back here. That's the Rattlesnake Wilderness Area. We have a national wilderness area that borders city limits. Can't beat that. It's really, really great. We get a tremendous diversity of insects on our farm because of our biological continuity with the wilderness area. A naturalist a few years ago did a study at our farm, caught 52 different species of butterflies over the course of a summer. He did the same study on another farm on the west side of the valley that's surrounded by sterile suburb, but the production methods at that farm are the same. 12 species of butterflies. So it's not our production methods, it's where we're located. This is a CSA table in spring. This is that hemorrhagic effect of harvesting on organic matter. Off it goes. This is early spring, June berries. So we've got strawberries, chard, broccoli, cabbage, scallions, different color cabbage, different color lettuce. This is early on. But this is the table where I want the people to walk in and go, wow, it looks really beautiful. And it does look really beautiful. If you like this kind of thing, this is really beautiful. The livestock auction. Straw to make compost. See, isn't it better that I just talk to you first and show this slide? This is making that lasagna method, compost by hand. It's not a very good picture. I didn't have a good manure spreader picture. For those of you who were on the tour yesterday, Jen did an awesome demonstration. That's a manure spreader. They break all the time. It's. I had a great quote at the John Deere dealership. I actually put it in an upcoming book on farm poetry. I just copied this guy's sentence down on manure spreaders. The job they're designed to do ruins them. Yeah. Isn't that good? Isn't that, you had to write shit like that down. Yeah. Isn't that the way with all of us? Like, the job they're designed to do ruins them. Oh. So we'll slow down a little bit this. Here's our spader and our tractor. We have a little bit smaller Kubota than Matt and Jen. It's a 47 horse at the engine, 40 at the PTO. It's a 60-inch spader. And you can see here, look at the color of the ground. It's beautiful. I mean, this is awesome soil. We didn't make it so much as we haven't ruined what we were given. Compost is spread right next to it. So that's not the natural color of the soil to the left. That's the color of the compost. The soil is that color. And we just did this last week. It had been raining. It stopped raining. 2 days of sun. There was a brief window, and then it was going to rain again. We had to get garlic beds made, and you just got to jump on it. And this is the kind of intensity I think is super good for students to experience. There's a window for tillage. It doesn't matter what time it is because it's going to rain. We don't have time to talk. This is a student. I heard about students being on tractors, not being on tractors. This is Larry. Larry is breaking aces. He is brilliant, super handy, super smart. He's been around a long time. We're able to hire him as a TA. And he's on the tractor doing a bang-up job. Larry's a natural horticulturist, likes to tinker with plants. So this little close-up shot on the left over here, that's spaded ground. On the right, this is the compost. And you can see what happens. This is raised up. It's all full of air. It's ready to plant into. And after we spade it, we just drive over it with the tractor with no implement on the back. We just lift the spader up. And the weight of the tractor tires on that soft ground makes a really nice path, then a raised bed, and a nice path. We don't use a bed shaper. I understand that doesn't make as big a bed as some of the beds we saw yesterday, but it's a good 8 inches. And more than anything, it's a really nice place to walk. So now you have an obvious path and an obvious bed. So this one, I think, is the most important slide of the whole deal. Look at that destruction. This is the spader in action. Those paddles are moving 540 times a minute with the strength of 40 horses. Brutal. There are little icons on stickers all over this thing with the pictures of people bent in corkscrews. Aren't those awesome? Those should be t-shirts. I mean, we're talking serious violence happening here to our soil. Oh, we're caring, we're doing sustainable farming, blah, blah, blah. No, we're shredding the shit out of everything. We cannot do this year in and year out. Absolutely cannot do it. As wonderful it is as a way to get organic matter to the soil, we can't do this all the time. Fertility, no problem. I feel like broccoli is the vegetative barometer of fertility. Look at that broccoli. That's like plate size. And we had tons of broccoli like that. And we had tons of broccoli like this, Because this broccoli was grown on the ground that last year was in 3-year cover crop, and it had beautiful compost applied to it. And we grew the right variety, and we didn't let it get too weedy, and we planted it at the right time. All those other things are really important too. So I mentioned annual cover crops and spring greens. These are spring greens. That's our hoop house. Same shot, month and a half later. Look at all that cover crop. Now this will be in cover crop until next spring, then it'll get tilled in. And then it takes about 4 or 5 weeks to decompose, and then we'll plant cucurbits in here, which can't handle a frost. From the time we till this in till the time it's decomposed so we can plant into it, we will have passed the last frost date. So we have to follow a spring cover crop with something that needs to grow in the summertime. There's way more to that explanation than I just gave you, but just bear with me. That's the same view of the patch from up above. Here's our 3-year cover crop patch. And back there is a little native plants because it's super rocky back there. A graduate student put that in. And right here is where the flatbed trailer lived and we had a big party, and here's where they all danced. And this is what it was last year. So this year, last year. And that's a close-up of it right now. All that wonderful organic matter on top, great roots growing underneath, and no evil spaders shredding everything up. Okay, so with that, I bet we can go over just a little bit. I'd love to prove to me you remained awake and ask some questions. Please. Sure, if it'll work with straw, maybe we can pull it off. I don't know. I would love to get to that, but here, I'll keep going with manure.
Yeah.
So it's the only source. They feed their animals alfalfa. There is a really evil herbicide out there called Tordon that's sprayed often on unirrigated pastures, and it remains in manure for up to 7 years. They don't feed any grass. They feed all alfalfa, so I can sort of be okay with that. There also aren't a whole lot of chemicals applied to beef cattle because there's some antibiotics, but these guys are being sold to then go off to a feedlot where they're pumped full of all kinds of nastiness.
Right.
For the most part, these guys are on pasture, or they're eating grass, or they're eating hay where they came from before.
They just inherently have really bad enterotoxins superbugs in their stomach. I mean, it's just like a GI tract trait of a large ruminant.
Well, we compost them.
Okay.
So, and cows are just spectacular at their ability to take grass, bring it almost to the point of being humus. What they do in their digestive systems is spectacular. And if anybody's familiar with biodynamics, the biodynamic people believe that the cows can literally read what's going on in the soil with their stomachs. They have 6 of them. Cows apprehend the world not with their eyes like we do, but with their digestive tract. And they try and give back to the soil what they're taking out in some kind of magical cow alchemy. So I feel like cow manure is a great thing to make compost out of. It sucks for weed seeds. It's also only what's available, and it's legit by organic standards. You don't have to have organic manure to have an organic farm. It's readily available. It's what we got to work with. So for all these reasons, I'm basically okay with it, though it is not my first choice. My first choice at this moment, if I could have anything, would be to have our farm right next to an organic dairy, and we could just get all the compost and all the manure and straw from their loafing shed, but it doesn't exist. Maybe we could do what you guys do. Remains to be seen. Good question. So it's a pasture mix, and it's a mix of a bunch of different grasses and clovers. And we bought it as a pasture mix. It's called Buckhorn pasture mix. Works really well in irrigated pastures in Montana. A handful of clovers and grasses.
We did, yeah. We do mow it. We don't mow it. We let it get big, and then we mow it. And we don't mow it too often, but a few times, especially before that party.
And so do you probably have another section? Because you'd always have four sections of the field. If you want to, you always have something
in
for your...
Yep.
Right? So do you have it broken up like that now?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, when I showed you that picture of the overview, it looks like two parts of the parking lot in the middle, but we've broken it up into four. Okay, if you can get away from tillage with a major tool like this, you could probably farm forever anyway. So if you're doing, maybe you do the initial work only once, like turning it from sod into garden soil, you can do that with a tractor. But after that, if you do work by hand, you could probably farm forever. No person can do the destruction that a spader does, unless you get on there where it's really wet and you like try and vandalize it. But if you do it when the timing is right, I don't think you can ruin it by hand. Now, I've heard that animal agriculture, much less intensive. I don't know for sure. I haven't been part of it. But, you know, and you can just be super thoughtful and sparing about it. You know, there's another farm nearby us that did a cool thing where she would have a bed and a path and a bed and plants the paths into a cover crop and tills the beds up annually for a couple of years, and then she switches and puts the beds on top of the paths. Now, the paths are narrower than the beds, but you're still working that direction. You know, you get organic matter and a reduction of the destruction in tillage.
Do you apply any other supplemental fertilizers for your crops?
It's a good question. Only when needed, not as a matter of course. So we had some issues with the cold and the celery going through really bad transplant shock, and we used some nettle tea. Stinging nettles grow wild nearby where we live, and they are super full of nitrogen. Just amazing. Bears really like to eat them because they're just packed with energy. You have to harvest them with gloves and Carhartts because it stings you, but Larry, the awesome horticulturist on the tractor, harvested a whole bunch. We made a big 50-gallon drum of nettle tea. It's really complicated and hard to do. You take the nettles, shove them in a burlap sack, tie it to a 2x4, and sink it in water until it stinks, and you're good to go. We cut it 50-50 with water and spray it on there, and it's a big nitrogen boost. We've also used some fish emulsion in a similar situation in the greenhouse, but only when needed, as needed in a sort of medicinal way rather than as a standard practice. Space, and on that, it's like probably 2 acres, 2.5 acres. It's really about responsibilities and time. So in the wintertime, this place shuts down. We have a caretaker who lives in an apartment in that barn, and we have chickens that overwinter, but that's it. From early November to the last week of February, there's nothing there. And it gets cold and icy and dark and gray. And to ask somebody to take care of animals during that time of year when you don't have to, and the students aren't there then, it's just a lot.
Well, you rent the land out for a month after your little birdie.
Well, look, we have students out there until the end of October. So, I mean, maybe we could, it would just be really hard for me to wrap my mind around how it can work. So, and it would work especially if some student's like, I want to raise sheep this year, and this is what I'm going to do, and this is my plan, and we're going to get some portable electric fencing, I'm going to set up a solar thing, and I'm going to guarantee that they're never going to get out, and I'm going to be there every Saturday and Sunday, even if it's 2 degrees below zero, or my girlfriend needs to ride to the airport, or whatever, they're still going to pull it off. It's tough to, I want to stack the odds towards success. And if somebody came with a really strong proposal, I'd be open to it. But right now, I really want to make sure we have just enough responsibility to make us work really hard, but not enough responsibility to make us blow it.
If you're turning an area that's been grass for a while into a farm, can you just till it?
Well, the first thing I would want to know is what is growing there now.
Grass.
So which kind of grass? So, and I'm not trying to be a smart aleck, but there are some grasses that grow... They reproduce through seed. And there's some, a whole bunch of really nasty ones all around America that grow and reproduce rhizomatously. So use the blade of grass, it sends a root down horizontally to the surface of the soil, and at every node, every 4, 6, 8 inches, it makes another shoot going up. And if you till up that grass, they call it quack grass where I live, I've heard it called Johnson grass, Bermuda grass and other places. If you till that up, every little piece of root is going to make another blade of grass. So you can't just till that up, you have to get rid of it. And the way we get rid of it in Western Montana, it may be different here, is to use a tool people call a quacker. Hey, it's a king of quackgrass, right? It's also called the spring-toothed harrow. And you do is you go over the field every different direction, every 10 days or so, in anticipation of the frost, so it's going to die off in the cold in the winter. Or you do it in spring and summer, where it's going to dry out and die in the weather, in the wind. But we have really dry weather, so that works. I'm not sure how you kill quack where it rains or where you don't have a frost, but I would kill the quack. If you don't have quack, I would disc it just a little bit to break it up, and then I would spade it a couple times. And do this, I would do this in the fall, ahead of springtime. And that spring freeze and thaw is really going to help break up the soil, and then hit it one more time before planting, and then off you go.
We have time for one more question.
Any machinery? Right. You have a small area. You have people. I would get in there with forks and rakes and shovels and have at it like people have been doing since they've been people. Claire, do you have a question? Yes. We do that and we feed it to our pigs. And pigs, if you don't have them, I would get some. They do this super magical alchemy. They turn garbage into bacon. That's what we do. But we do encourage people to feed the pigs. And it connects them to the pigs. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.